session number 11281, reel 1.
Mr. Kelly, reel 1. Can you tell me whereabouts you were born, please, first of all?
Well, I was born in Liverpool. In a street called Doncaster Street. That's been demolished.
And what did your father do for a living?
My father was a sailmaker, and so was his entire family, actually, including his father. His father actually was the man in charge of of the building where he worked.
And did you go to school in Liverpool?
Yes, I went to St. Anthony's School, yes.
How old were you when you left?
14 years of age.
To do what?
Well, in actual fact, there were no jobs at the time. This was a very, very bad time when I left school in the 1930s. And I was out of work, without a job, for a couple of years. And then I went to an electrical firm, which was a large shop. But then, of course, none of the businesses were very large in those days. Not like you see them now. And I served my time as an electrician then, if you could call it that, the way they said the time in those days.
And when the war came, what were you doing then?
Well, when the war started, I was still working there when the war started, and I think I was about 17 years of age. And because the war started, because of the war being imminent, the drivers at this firm, and they had several drivers of different types of vehicles, three-wheeler motorbike types of vehicles, a couple of them were, and others were the little Ford vans. And they were called up, and they went into the, well, at least one of them anyway that I knew of, or was friendly with, they went into the RASC, which was the, the transport thing in the army, the units in the army. And he left, and he was short of drivers. So as you could learn to drive then, when you were 17 years of age and you could get a license, I took up driving then as well, to help out. And of course it was better for me. But that lasted until the bombing started at the end of, the early 1941. I think the first raid we got was Christmas of 40, perhaps, and then the May Blitz. And my home was hit on both occasions.
Where was your home?
In Doncaster Street, the home that I live in Doncaster Street.
Which part of Liverpool is that?
That's Liverpool 5, the area of 5. It's sort of the very inner city, sort of. Type of terraced house, workers' homes, as they were. And the first raid, the back end of the house was sliced off with the bomb, but it exploded in the entry, the alleyway at the back. And fortunately for us, the blast, because we were all seated in the kitchen at the time, in the living room. And I think what saved us was the backyard door and the door of the toilet. And both of them were flattened against the window. A lot of the windows fell in. They were flattened against the windows, and tons of clay were packed up against them. And the back end of the roof, over the back end of the house, was absolutely completely sheared off. And my youngest brother, Billy, he was in bed at the time, and I just ran up, not thinking about it, just ran up, and the girders from the roof had just missed him. The big wooden beams had just missed him in the bed, and they were angled across the bed, supported by each wall, and they just missed him. Anyway, we got him out, and without any bother, and we suffered no casualties there.
And were you bombed out again, did you do that?
Well, the second time was in the May Blitz, when it was finished off by incendiaries, actually. the whole the corner of the street was actually destroyed by incendiary bombs. And that's, in actual fact, was the time when I first thought about joining the Royal Marines. Or if I had to join a unit, I would join the Royal Marines. Because my eldest brother was already in the Marines then. And he was home on leave, and he was about easily 6 inches taller than I am. He was 6'4" or 6'5", something like that. And he looks absolutely magnificent in his blue uniform. And he was immaculate, you know, that where you saw everybody else slouching around or marching around in these ungainly battle dresses as they were at that time, with the big horse's collar on and several sizes too large. He was immaculately dressed in his blues. And they had another blue suit, like a denim sort of suit, for working in. Which was that in itself was a uniform as well. And still looked smart on him. And he lost his home, too, because he lived quite, not more than about four doors from us. And his home was destroyed, too.
Before we take the Marines on any further, if I can ask you some more questions about the Liverpool Blitz. Why didn't your family ever use shelters?
Well, that's quite right. My father wouldn't permit us to go into shelter. We never used a shelter.
Why wouldn't he permit it?
Well, the shelters that were built in the streets were only little flimsy brick things with a 6-inch concrete top on, which wasn't really solid concrete either. They were very, very poor, and they were very, very dark and dismal and dank inside. And as they weren't used, because we didn't get that many raids on Liverpool, the interval between raids, of course, left them filthy inside, with a lot to be desired anyway. And they were very, very dark, and kids used to just play in them, you know, running, and you use them as play pens. And, of course, they gradually accumulate a lot of dirt and whatnot. But during the May Blitz, I must admit, a lot of people did start to use them then. But it wasn't just our family who ignored them. I don't think anybody, well, very few ever went in. Most people preferred to go into one of their homes and use their company as protection.
Go to where?
Into each other's homes, neighbours' homes.
Whereabouts in the home would you hide?
Well, they only kept on the ground floor, you see, and on the tables and under the stairwells. But they were the only places. We didn't have cellars in our homes. In actual fact, it was the May Blitz when they... yes, I think it was the May Blitz. When they hit the houses opposite to us with a high explosive. And they killed an old lady in one of them. She wouldn't come out, and she was in the house. And she was buried under the rubble. But in the next door at the house, which was partly demolished, my wife was babysitting for the young man and the young woman. And the young man was in the RAF and at home on leave. And they'd gone out for a night out, and the woman who was my wife now, she was in there. And I dragged her out of the window, underneath the sashes, and everybody black as the ace of spades, with the soot and the dust and things like that. But I remember dragging her out, and she was still clutching that child. She still had that child clutched to her, even though she was nearly killed herself.
How frightening did you find the raids?
Well, I don't think frightening is the word for a young man. It's excitement, really. And once, if you stand back from it and watch it, I suppose that it is frightening. And you know, you do get this tingle and you know, the within you, you know. But I don't think I could honestly say that I was actually frightened. It was more of an exciting time, and while you had something to do. But afterwards was a distressing time. It was all very nice for me to be running around the streets with gay abandon. You know, having nobody to look after, only myself. And knowing that my eldest brother was there climbing on roofs, kicking incendiaries off. And my father had made lots, because he was a sailmaker, had made lots of little sandbags, little handy sandbags. And we had them stacked in the house, lots of them. And we were running down the streets, and my eldest brother had showed us how to, don't worry about an incendiary, don't be afraid of us, go up and just empty the sand all over us. And that's what we were doing.
So did it work?
Yes, it dampened. It did put the incendiary out, but it stopped all the glow and the heat and stopped it from burning anything. And we merely kicked them into the gutter and away from anything inflammable and then put the sand on them.
What did these incendiaries look like then?
Long, thin cylinders about 2 inches in diameter, about 18 inches long, with a fin on the end. That was meant to guide them. And I don't know whether they exploded on impact, or when they were jettisoned from the aircraft, they used to jettison them in thousands, I think, from a bigger container. Whether they were activated on the way down, I wouldn't know about that. But when they burst, they glowed, and they were like. They were like a huge sparkler, and you know the way the sparkler goes white and reddish towards the edges where it's cooler. But in the centre, it's white hot. Well, that's the way they used to burn. With phosphorus, I think it was. And of course, they were very destructive weapons if they in an enclosed place. And they certainly set fire to things, no question about them. And they burned us out anyway, even though we'd spent all our time kicking them off other people's roofs. And dousing them in the streets. And in actual fact, my eldest brother had to overstay his leave because he was left with his wife and child. And he was put on a charge when he went back to the Royal Marines, back down to Plymouth, where he came from. And when he went back, he was a week adrift. And the police actually intervened on his behalf, saying, that he had put this... such good work in during the Blitz, both from the point of view of saving property and from the morale point of view of everybody around the place, because he showed them that there was nothing to be afraid of these things, you know. And he put his tin hat on one, he got charged for a new tin hat because we ran out of sand and things like that. But he wouldn't throw water on them. He stopped there was an ARP warden. I remember the ARP warden running with a bucket of water. Grabbed a bucket of washing water off out of somebody's house, and he was going to throw it on. And I remember Geordie stopping him and calling them all the fools. He said, "If you throw that water on there," he said, that will explode in millions of bits. He said, "You won't put it out with water." He said, "It will merely just create an explosive in it." He said, "Just as soon as the cold water hits it, it will explode as thousands of fragments, and everybody will have it all over the place." He said, "So leave it." And he said, "It's doing no harm in the middle of the street anyway. It will just burn itself out." He said, "So if you just turn," he said, "empty the bucket down the gutter. Throw the water down the gutter. I'll just put the bucket on the top of it if you want to stop the light." He said, "But those fellas up there," he said, "they're not worried about the one." He said, "Look at the place. And everywhere was burning in Liverpool. By that time, there's nothing but you could see quite clearly, you know. And of course, our houses were going well then, you know, as well. So,
which parts of Liverpool got worst hit then?
Well, it was pretty widespread, actually. The city did get, and the docks certainly got a whacking on that night. And of course, the houses down by the docks. And we were just in the unfortunate position, I think, of where if they came in from one direction, you were likely to get the overspill of them. The undershot ones, where they let them go too quick for the docks. And if they came in the opposite direction, you're likely to get the overspill, where they let them go too late. Of course, they were the last ones to come out of the aircraft would hit us. But you could tell at least from my brother's point of view, he said that's what saved the house in the first instance with the bombs, because the bombs were heading down at an angle. And that's why they sliced the back. They don't drop straight down, you know, with the momentum going forward. If it dropped straight down, of course, they would have hit the house smack on the top. And none of us would have got out. But with it going at an angle, it just, and of course the blast went with it.
When did the worst raids occur in Liverpool?
Well, I think the May Blitz was the worst one. The others were intermittent and were not, they didn't last very long, you know, maybe one or two nights. But the May Blitz went on for about a week, I think. And that really demoralised everybody here, or started to get them down. I know that in the evening, halfway through the week anyway, that when they had started this bombing campaign, the men were ushering the women out and the kiddies out in the evening about 6 o'clock, round about this time at night. They'd get them all up onto Scotland Road and they'd pile them onto trams, and they came to live out this way, not a screen, where it was comparatively safe. I mean, they were unlucky to get bombed in this area, although they did hit the railway.
We're in the Walton area, aren't we?
Yes. They did hit the railway just across the road there, and as it happened, it had an ammunition train on it at the time. But I think that was a fluke. I don't think they got hit at that time with the bombing. Mind you, at that time, I suppose we thought they could. But we've since found out that they weren't as accurate as what they said they were.
You say that people got demoralised. What was public morale like?
Well, when I say demoralised, I think that it was more a fear of people thinking of their relatives rather than having any fear for themselves, or that things wouldn't be right. I think that it was mostly that the worry was to get their families away. And then, of course, when the families got away, they'd be worrying about the men at home. But the men at home who had jobs... See, my father, for example, he worked, and because he didn't make sales then, of course, but he's still in the same industry. But what they made then were these canvas shields for warships around the bridge of destroyers. And an assortment of things like that which came up with the war and which were needed by ships. And it kept them busy, and they were working. He worked long hours. And several nights in the week, he would have to go back and do a night of fire watching. And they all did that on the buildings in the city. Now, for what good? I don't know, but maybe a lot of buildings would be saved from incendiaries if they attacked them in time. And every building was supposed to have bags of sands and buckets of water on the passageways and alleyways at the tops of the buildings.
Were people defiant towards the Germans then?
There's obviously a section of the people who will who won't feel too good about it, but I think the animosity towards the Germans in this city anyway got to a fairly high point over the damage that they'd done, and if they could have got their hands on any of them at the time, I wouldn't have given much for their chances.
Do you think they would have harmed any of the aircrew if they'd have fallen into their hands?
Well, I wouldn't say that they would have got away without some sort of a belting. I'm certain they would have, even if they hadn't killed them or anything of that nature, or meant to do that, I think they'd certainly give them a punching, and they would have been beaten up if they'd have got hold of any of them. Because as the city was, the aircraft very rarely. I can't remember of any instance where any aircraft crashed actually on the city. They did all around it, of course. You know, and, an aircraft to come down if it was hit might take a mile or so from the height that it was at and the speed it was going. Would be a mile away from the city before it ever hit the deck, maybe even more.
Did people feel that the authorities were doing enough to protect the city?
Well, they didn't. That was one very salient point. But then, of course, I don't think they understood the strategy of fighter aircraft meeting these bombers before they ever got to the city, rather than attacking them over above the city. So I don't think I think that they were misled there, but they certainly voiced that opinion that they you know where are our aircraft? They were always saying that to them, because we never saw them, you see, and you didn't see any dogfights because they always took place miles away from us.
What about the anti-aircraft fire?
Well, there was plenty of anti-aircraft fire, and a little disappointment that not a great many aircraft were shot down. Had they been able to see them exploding in the air, although there was one or two who did get hit, and it caused a great amount of cheering. But not that many. The majority of them were... if they were damaged, they managed to get away, and we never saw them coming down. But the aircraft, the anti-aircraft batteries, we knew were there because the noise was absolutely fantastic. And they had mobile batteries as well that moved about the city, and plunked themselves at strategic points throughout the city to help us.
What did you think of the work that the emergency services, like the ambulances and fire brigade and so on, did?
Well, most certainly, I would say that the ambulances and the fire service, although the fire service was greatly hampered by the fact that they had no water, and even though the city was a death trap of tubes, steel tubes on the surface. And we had a water main surface running around the sides of the pavements, running for miles and miles, where they could get water from. Now and then they had these emergency water tanks, which were just like brick squares, wherever they could put them, cemented inside and filled with water, like swimming pools, little swimming pools. But they were sorely hampered, I think, with the fact that their equipment wasn't good enough, and the fact that the water supply, when it got hit, left them without anything to fight the fires with.
You were talking about your father having all that much overtime. Were people much better off then in the war because of the wages?
Oh, no. I don't think it made any difference to our standard of living, because there was... there was nothing to buy. It was a struggle for women with the rations to eat them out. Although most of them, I think, managed fairly successfully to do that. You know, and there was a little bartering system in between people, where if a person was working and had maybe a reasonable wage, they could have butter of other people who wouldn't use it, because they have a cheaper margarine, and they would swap coupons in that way, you see, and maybe clothing coupons, because people couldn't afford to get the clothes. They would rather have the money instead. So, by and large, I think people managed on the rations that they got, and as far as them having jobs and the money was concerned, most of it was taken in tax. A great proportion of us were taken in tax. And they were given these post-war credit things. Now, how many of those were ever cashed after the war? God only knows if ever anybody still had them or thought of them. I wouldn't know.
Now, can we pick up your story in the Marines, and can you tell me how you came to be in the Marines?
Oh, well, very quickly, I'll be as quick as I can with this story of how I joined it. I had no intention of volunteering. My father had always said to me that never to volunteer. He had been the only one in his family to volunteer in the 1914 war. However, because of the Blitz, my boss, I wanted to, and my being a driver, I went up to my boss one night during the raid and asked him if I could borrow the van to take my mother and my family up to stop with a relative in Norris Green. I said, I'll only be an hour. So he said, oh no, he said, we're using it. He said, we're doing the same thing ourselves. He said, we're just running, and he mentioned a different family, and I knew the families. I knew his family. And he said, well, we're just running them out. So I knew he had, you know, three or four vehicles, and no drivers for them all. And it was rather surprising. But as it happened, that night, I was walking up the road with my mother from from our home, and walking her up Everton Valley to see her on her way, and trying to get a lift. But horses and carts and wagons would stop for the people, and it was nothing to see a flat-backed wagon loaded with people sitting on it and standing on it, running them out to wherever they wanted to go. And everybody, cooperated with one another amazingly. I was walking up Kirkdale Road, and there was the shop, and outside the shop with a line of vehicles, all being loaded with furniture. And I went into him, I said, so these are the people you are taking to safety, Arnie, furniture. And I never went back to that job again. I finished with that job. And he came down to our house, and my mother pleaded with me to go back. I said, I'm not going back to him. I said, all the despicable things to do. I said, that's disgraceful. And I told him so to his face. And I said, I'm only a young man. I wasn't 18. And I said, a coward, a rat, call them for everything. And but that's the way I felt at the time. Anyway, I went with my friend then. The jobs were plentiful. And I went with my friend, and he said, I'll get you a job. And he worked in the Northern Tanning Company in Hawthorne Road, Bootle. And I went along there, and I got a job straight away. And a much better paid job, because they said, well, if you can work like a man, you'll get paid like a man, which made an enormous difference to my wages. It trebled, the wage that I've got. So I said, oh, I'll have a go. It was very, very hard work, and I wasn't used to it at all. It took me a long weeks and weeks. But it certainly made a difference to me physically. Where I had a very steady, easy-going job, no hard, real hard work attached to it, I now had to work hard. And the friend I'm talking about, this Sonny Curdy, he was a six-foot lad, and he was built like a man at 18 years of age. And I think he was 18. Anyway, we worked there for about 3 months, I think, until around about the December of 40, and the British came on, and we had that problem. And as the spring came, 41, he says to me, he said, I'm fed up. Now, he was a chap who did get a little bit, footloose and fancy free, and he'd want to move all the time. And as I say, jobs were easy to come by. But he wanted to join up. So I said, I'm not sure. And I said, my father would kill me. I said, if I join up, I said, he'd batter me. I said, I'd have to face the Germans and him. I said, holy sir, he'd murder me. However, after about a week of this solid grinding, he wore me down. And we went and we joined up, or we went down to join up in Renshaw Street. And we joined the long queue of people all going along there. They're all conscripts.